Marketplace is supported by Invest Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, a European location offering a skilled, loyal, agile workforce at the ready. More at investni.com.
If you're invested in Greek stocks, first of all, why? Second of all, how do you feel about your money going it alone without the European Union? Because it's entirely possible. That's where we've come to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life through its affiliated companies in the United States. AllianzUSA.com. And by Battelle. Battelle's NeuroBridge technology is helping a paralyzed man to move again. Learn more at Battelle.org.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, everybody, the 9th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us. It's been, I know, a good long while since Alan Greenspan got top billing on this program, but so it goes in the funhouse that is the global economy. Remarking on the most recent goings-on over in Europe, renewed speculation over the weekend that Greece may be on its way out of the European Union, voluntarily or un, Mr. Greenspan said, and this is a quote, "It's just a matter of time before everybody recognizes parting is the best strategy." Economically, perhaps. Politically, probably not. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the latest.
The euro is like building a castle of cards. Take out the Greek card and the whole thing will collapse, the words of Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. His friend and former colleague James Galbraith of the University of Texas says absolutely right. He says it's a timely reminder to Germany, the eurozone's economic superpower and the country that's calling the shots in Greece's bailout negotiations.
The German government does not wish to see and would not like to be the author of a course of events that destabilizes and might ultimately destroy the eurozone and the European Union.
But would Greece's forced departure from the eurozone really be so bad? The country only accounts for 2% of the bloc's economy. A few weeks ago, German government sources were quoted saying a Greek exit would be manageable. Tell that to nervous investors, says Greek government economist Yanis Milios.
The markets will conceive this move as a door being opened for the next country to exit. And the whole single currency area is going to collapse within minutes.
He says Germany's biggest market, the rest of Europe, would be in turmoil. And as the continent's biggest creditor, Germany could be left with $2 trillion worth of bad debt. Like many analysts, Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform says Germany can't afford to let the Greeks go.
They need to keep Greece within the eurozone, and ultimately that is going to involve compromise on the part of the Germans and other core eurozone governments as much as it will on the Greek side.
Holding the eurozone together is seen as vital to maintaining European unity. But the cracks are widening. Today, the British Prime Minister held a special meeting with officials to plan for a possible Greek exit from the eurozone. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
To paraphrase Scott McNeely, the former CEO of Sun Microsystems, who famously once said, "You've got no privacy, get over it," you may have no security either. Whether you get over it or not is obviously up to you. But if you drive a newish car, you do have a vested interest in this conversation. A Senate report out today on the wireless technology that is being used in new cars says they can be hacked with something as simple as an iPad. And more to the point, car makers, including most of the biggies, aren't doing much to protect us or our data. The phrase you're looking for here is the Internet of Things, to which cars are just the most recent addition. And it's an ecosystem where, as Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports, innovation comes first and security often scrambles to keep up.
Steve Checkaway can do things to your car that'll keep you awake at night, like remotely control your brakes or the gas. And he says hacking cars has gotten easier.
As cars have added more functionality, have added more wireless interfaces,
like Wi-Fi hotspots and the ability to stream Netflix in the back seat. Checkaway is a researcher at the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute.
Every time you add a new point of connectivity to a device, you have increased the attack surface, more ways to gain access.
Lots of previously closed systems, like cars, are opening up to the internet, from lighting fixtures to TVs to thermostats. They're getting connected and talking to each other. Tom Kerber studies this phenomenon at Parks Associates. He says Silicon Valley is grappling with a balancing act.
The out-of-the-box experience, when you start up a product, when you unpackage it, put it on the wall, needs to be very seamless.
If users have too many security walls to put up, he says, they'll just return the products. And there's another roadblock to keeping out hackers and protecting our data, Silicon Valley culture.
Innovation in Silicon Valley is all about iteration and experimentation.
Analyst Frank Gillette of Forrester Research advises chief information officers. He says that experimentation tends to mean products aren't fully cooked when they come to market.
So the idea is figure out the minimum viable product that'll let you experiment with an idea, develop it, and see if there's something there, and then figure out how to improve it, iterate it, make it better.
Gillette says that means security is often playing catch-up, and that model is not likely to change anytime soon. In New York, I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
You want a reason why stocks failed today? Is that what you want? All right, here's one. Greece. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Make of this what you will, but analysts at Citigroup came out today and said they think oil could go as low as $20 a barrel. And hang on to your hat that the current volatility in crude could spell the end of OPEC. Economic crystal balls being somewhat unreliable, we're just going to have to wait to see how that one plays out. But for countries whose economy depends on what comes out of the ground, the crash in oil prices the past 6 months has been rough. Venezuela is an OPEC member. It's also the number five source of imported oil to this country. The BBC's Daniel Pardo is on the line now from Caracas. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Venezuelan economy has been, I think it's safe to say, troubled for a number of years now. What effect have oil prices had?
Well, Venezuela is one of the most dependent countries on oil in the world. 95% of Venezuela's exports, meaning 95% of Venezuela's revenue, comes from oil. So this is a country that probably the only thing that it produces is oil. And it's a country that depends a lot on imports. 70% of Venezuela's food consumption comes from abroad. So imagine if you have little revenue now, you have little imports. So that has generated more shortages and just an atmosphere of tension on the streets of Venezuela.
So the government has big subsidy programs in place, right? I mean, the gasoline there is the cheapest in the world. I'm sure there are other kinds of subsidies that the government of President Nicolas Maduro puts in place. Can the government still keep up those subsidies even when its receipts are down because of oil prices?
Well, that's what they are saying. It's very difficult to know how are they going to pay for that. President Maduro spent more time abroad outside Venezuela in January than in Venezuela. And that's because he went on a world tour. He went to China, he went to Russia twice, he went to Iran, because he wanted to get some loans, get some money so he could pay for the imports. It's not clear what he got from that. He said that he got $20 billion in investments from China, but that's not cash. And what he needs is cash, money to be able to buy food so that people can eat.
All right, here's the $64,000 question. How does a country which is so rich in natural resources, one specific natural resource, how does it wind up with things like sporadic power outages in the capital and inflation, which is very nearly runaway inflation, food shortages and lines for hours for staples? How does that happen?
Venezuela has always been a very rich country. I come from Colombia, which is the nearby country, and we always saw Venezuela as a country that was very developed, that had huge avenues and huge and really good infrastructure. That has changed now. You know, Colombia has developed and Venezuela has stayed in the 70s or the 80s. During this crisis, in the past 2 years, inflation has been so high in this country that poverty has dramatically increased.
What about the people in this economy, though? Are they angry? I mean, we've been reading in the press that they're out in the streets. They're standing in line for hours to buy bread and staples. Do they have any hope that this gets better?
I'm not sure if they have hope that it's going to change, but I am sure that they don't entirely blame the government for it. Because many of the people that you speak to on lines outside of supermarkets will tell you that the lines are caused, and this is the government's narrative, and this is what they're using. They'll say that the queue is the store's fault, basically, that this is the private sector hoarding the products, increasing prices, and people believe that.
Daniel Pardo with the BBC in Caracas, Venezuela. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're about to get to the rubber meets the road part of the new educational standards known as Common Core. Policies have been debated, syllabi have been built, and now comes the testing. Schools around the country are gearing up for their first rounds of Common Core exams. And those tests are, as you know, controversial. The disagreements are largely political, but testing like this is a big business. From the Education Desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story.
Think standardized test. Maybe you picture kids sitting at their desks filling in bubbles with number two pencils. A Scantron machine cranking out scores. Time to update that picture to look more like this. Kids at computers dragging and dropping answers on screens, using online highlighters and calculators, and watching videos like this TED Talk about building electrical circuits with Play-Doh.
Circuits that the most creative, tiny little hands can build on their own.
That clip is from a sample Common Core test for seventh graders. Students are asked to read two articles, watch the video, and then write an essay supporting their response with evidence from each source. Yeah, no bubbles in sight.
Whether it's the English test or the math test, there's a great emphasis on constructing responses to questions.
Jeff Nellhaus is chief of assessment for PARC. That stands for the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. Let's stick with the acronym. It's one of two groups of states that shared $360 million in federal grants to create tests aligned with the Common Core standards. The standards focus on critical thinking, problem solving, and analytical skills. Nellhaus says the old measures won't do.
If you think about life, you have problems. You don't get multiple choice answers to them. You have to construct your own answers from your own knowledge and drawing on other sources to get information. That's what this test focuses on primarily.
And that's expensive. Scott Marion is associate director of the Center for Assessment. It helps states develop better tests. Marion says each question has to be written, then reviewed for things like bias and age appropriateness, and field tested. Then it may be revised or even thrown out. When you add up 9 grade levels, all with different tests in math and English, we're talking thousands and thousands of questions. Marion estimates a single multiple-choice question costs roughly $1,000 to develop.
When you get into more open-ended questions, you get into $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 per question.
That's because it's harder to write questions that demonstrate different levels of ability. They also have to be changed out every year or so. And those are just development costs. Then there's scoring.
Scoring open response questions generally requires human beings to read the papers and then assign scores.
Humans who need to be trained and monitored to make sure they're scoring fairly. PARC has tried to keep costs down. A feature on the math test lets students type in equations that can be scored by machine. And there will still be multiple choice. Nellhaus says PARC is also testing technology to score essays by computer.
We'll always have humans doing a check on the machines, but we're optimistic that we'll be able to incorporate this into the program within a few years.
The savings won't come soon enough for states like Georgia, which pulled out when PARC estimated its tests would cost about 3 times what the state had been spending. PARC's price has since come down to about $24 per student. That's less than what many states spend, but much more than others. And for some, not enough.
I think we're spending actually too little on testing. If we're talking about $30 a kid to round up, that's less than the cost of a textbook.
Matthew Chingos is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. A few years ago, he did a rough estimate of what states spend every year on K-12 assessment. He came up with about $1.7 billion out of more than $600 billion in total spending on public education.
So we're really talking about a small amount of money, especially in comparison to the importance that's attached to the results of these tests and the uses to which people want to put them, which is to hold teachers accountable, to improve schools, to hold schools accountable.
There's another reason tests are so important. They don't just measure what kids learn. We've all heard the phrase, teaching to the test. Park's Jeff Nellhaus says tests send a signal to teachers and principals.
What the test measures and how it measures it is going to have an impact on what they teach and how they teach it. So it's really incumbent on the test to be great.
A great test? It's hard to imagine students will see it that way when they get a load of the real thing in the next few months. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, filmmaker Ed Burns from the Brothers McMullen with the best advice his dad ever gave him.
There is some other kid out there who is working harder than you.
Man, ain't that the truth. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off a half of 1% this Monday. 95 points ended at 17,729. The NASDAQ slid about a third percent, 18 points, 47.26. The S&P 500 fell 0.4%. That is 8 points, finished at 2,046. Hasbro was one of the few stocks on the upside today. The game maker played up 7% after it released some good earnings news. Rival Mattel fell more than 1%. Netflix announced that its streaming service is now available in Cuba. Investors pretty much didn't care. Shares off 0.3%. Amazon fell nearly 1% today as well. McDonald's tumbled more than 1% after the fast food chain reported monthly sales were lower than expected thanks to weakness in Asia. Yum! Brands, that is to say KFC and Pizza Hut, and Shake Shack both fell 1% as well. Bond prices were down. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.96%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses meet their goals with email and online marketing. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Epson. Smart point-of-sale solutions are designed to help retailers succeed. Epson offers a new class of mobility to meet the growing demand for exceptional customer service in the world of retail. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for December. A Senate committee holds a hearing on the reemergence of vaccine-preventable diseases. And the first singing telegram is believed to have been delivered on February 10th, 1933. Oh, how thoughtful. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Brian Williams isn't going to be anchoring the NBC Nightly News tonight. He's taken himself off the air for the next several days. Those are his words, while NBC sorts things out. The short-term Nielsen ratings haven't been kind to Williams and his broadcast. NBC News lost 36% of its viewers in key age groups Friday night. That's never a viable proposition for what one has to remember is a strategic investment for its corporate parent company, Comcast. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has more on the business realities of network news.
Here's a fact. Nightly newscasts are a bit past their prime. Gabriel Kahn is a journalism professor at the Annenberg School at the University of Southern California.
At their height in 1980, about 75% of all television sets were turned to one of the three nightly news broadcasts. It was an incredible market penetration.
Today, networks are struggling to attract new and younger viewers. If you watch a 30-minute newscast today, it's easy to see who their audience is. A third of that half hour might be commercials, and many are aimed at older viewers. Think arthritis medicine.
in many ways, it's the same audience that was watching the program 20 years ago. They're just 20 years older.
But that doesn't mean programs like NBC Nightly News don't have tons of viewers or aren't critical to networks' overall strategies. Khan says the evening show is how they demonstrate that they're serious about news, and the evening anchors are the public face of that effort. Jesse Holcomb agrees. He's a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center.
And that's important for the brand, perhaps even more so than it's important for the bottom line.
He says the bottom line is important, too. Around 20 million people watch evening network newscasts each night, compared to around 3 million for cable news. For NBC alone, he says, that generates around $150 million a year in ad revenue. But let's go back to the brand. In NBC's case, Brian Williams himself. Hadass Gold is a media reporter at Politico.
He's very valuable to them not only because he has the number one nightly newscast, he's also valuable because he's considered a brand also outside of the news.
So what's NBC to do? One thing's for sure. Brian Williams' contract was renewed in December for an estimated $10 million per year. Breaking that would be messy and expensive. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Independent film was arguably in its prime back in the early 1990s. Spike Lee and Steven Soderbergh were hot. Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith were the new kids in town. And then in 1995, out of nowhere, by way of Valley Stream, Long Island, comes a guy named Ed Burns and his first movie. It was called The Brothers McMullen. Not only does Burns finagle an invitation to the Sundance Film Festival, he winds up winning the thing. Here we are now, 20 years later. Burns is a writer, producer, director, and actor. He is now also an author. His book about his not always completely smooth career is called Independent Ed. Ed, thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's cut right to the chase. You spend nights, weekends, $25,000 making The Brothers McMullen. You don't get anywhere. And then, true story, you run into Robert Redford.
Yeah, I'd sent the film to every distribution company, film festival, producer, agent, and got nowhere. And that went on for about a year. I was working at Entertainment Tonight. Redford was doing a junket for the film Quiz Show. And knowing that I was going to see him that afternoon during the interview, I brought my copy of McMullen on VHS and sat through his interview. And while he spoke, I went through my 30-second spiel about 100 times. And the minute the interview ended, he went to the elevator. I cut around the other door, met him there, gave him the spiel, handed him the VHS, and said, basically, I'm an indie filmmaker. I made this movie. I just need a little help. Would you please look at it or have someone in your office look at it? He took it and said, sure, we'll be in touch. And that was it. 6 months later or so, we get the phone call from the festival itself saying that the film has been accepted into competition. And then a few months after that, when I finally get up to Park City and the film screens, I meet Redford afterwards, and that's when he comes up to me and says, hey, you know, it took a lot of balls doing what you did, but, you know, when you're desperate, those are the things you have to do.
Well, you know, it's interesting you use that word because, and I mean, I guess you know this because you wrote the book and you lived the life, but there is a sense of desperation through this entire book.
Yeah, and, you know, I've written and directed 11 movies, six of which no one has ever heard of for the most part, unless you're like a real diehard fan. And those movies, not only did they get bad reviews and bomb at the box office, but some were even met with just complete apathy, which is worse. Yeah. So it was tough to sort of muster it up yet again to say, you know what? I know that I have something to say.
Well, and you come full circle film-wise in this book, right? You start with McMullen. You do some bigger budget pictures. And then you basically go back to your roots to try to rediscover what it is that you did.
I could not get a meeting in Hollywood. I could not get anyone to read my scripts. I couldn't get any talent attached to a couple of screenplays that I had written and I was trying to put together. And after sitting down with my producer, Aaron Lubin, we were kind of at a crossroads of, all right, well, what do we do now? And we started to talk about Brothers McMullen. And what we decided to do, you know, we were at a bar, and at the bar we started to write down, all right, here are the things, the sort of the McMullen guidelines. So, you know, $25,000. I said, all right, I can self-finance that. We'll start there. But then we thought, you know, we'll shoot it in 12 days like McMullen, only use unknown actors. They're all going to do their own hair and makeup. They've got to wear their own clothes. We're not going to pay for a single location, which means we've got to call in favors or just use city streets. and we're going to go back and use a three-man crew. And those were the guidelines we set up for Nice Guy Johnny as an experiment. Let's just see if we can do that again. And at $25,000, you know what? It's guaranteed to make its money back. And that's what we did. And the movie made a hell of a lot more money than $25,000.
Talk to me for a second about the idea of independent films, right? Because I think it's one of those amorphous terms out there. And I'd be curious as to what your operating definition of independent movie making is.
I've always said an independent film is a film that was independent of outside influence. And even though Woody Allen is never discussed or mentioned as an indie filmmaker, Woody is probably, our greatest independent filmmaker in that no one ever looks at his scripts. He always has final cut. He casts whoever he wants. If there was a singular voice and that person was able to make the movie without any interference, for me, that's what independent film is.
You're working now in television.
Yeah.
How did that come to pass? Because it seems in the book as if it was something you almost didn't want to do.
You know, like everyone else, in the last, whatever it's been, 10, 12 years, I've been such a fan of the great programming that's been available to us on cable. So, of course, as an indie filmmaker, I couldn't help but be sort of jealous of the creative freedom they had, but also the budgets that they were able to work with, and the fact that they were able to reach such a large audience. For indie filmmakers today, that is the toughest part. How do we find an audience, especially when no one's going to the theater? Long story short, we just finished shooting 10 episodes, which I wrote and directed all 10, and it was the dream project. The folks at TNT left us alone to make the show we wanted to make. You know, we were able to take sort of the indie film aesthetic and bring it over to basic cable.
When's it going on the air?
June. And it's called Public Morals.
Yeah, that's the most important part, man. I can't believe you forgot that part. The book by Edward Burns is called Independent Ed. It's about making movies and making a little television, too. Ed, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you, man.
We've got a couple of clips from the brothers McMullen and Nice Guy Johnny on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the sad reminder that the tax man will soon be upon us. The Internal Revenue Service said Friday that the average refund so far this year is running at $3,539, about which two things. First of all, who's got their taxes done already? Come on, cut it out, will you? Also, B, you guys all know that when you get a refund, you've basically given the government an interest-free loan, right? You know that? All right, there you go.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. In today's uncertain markets, institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price to find global investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. And by Malwarebytes, engineered to deliver a smart defense against zero-day malware, exploits, and ransomware for business, for home. More at malwarebytes.org/marketplace.
Gotta go. That's Marketplace for today. The Dow dropped a half of 1%, 95 points. The Nasdaq off a third of 1%, that is 18 points. The S&P 500 fell 0.4%, 8 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.